Numbers chapter 4 is where we arrive tonight. So would you do this with me? Would you do this for me? Would you just kind of pause whatever you're doing and let's just go before the Lord and ask for his blessing on all these things that are happening. God, we do ask for your blessing because of who you are. We're grateful for what your word is. Grateful for what it does. I'm grateful even how it works in our hearts and our minds, and just the worries and the busyness and the craziness of the last 5 or 6 weeks. You are still who you are. Nothing can ever challenge that. You are God. There is no other. So as we approach you in our study of your word, oh Lord, would you make it clear? And even as we get into some of these, in one sense, these are kind of cumbersome laws in that they apply to directly the nation of Israel. And they apply to the nation of Israel prior to the cross of Jesus Christ. And Jesus, you who came not to do away with the law, but to fulfill it you have. So Lord, may we find some application, some understanding as to why these things were put into place by you through Moses for your people and for us as Christians on this side of the cross. We're not Jewish. It's a different covenant, different plan for them. Would you at least help us to understand these things, and may our own personal Bible reading just bear a little bit more fruit as we understand your word all the more. So again, we thank you for this time. Lord, anyone that's traveling tonight, across the states, there's so many states impacted by the storm. Keep people safe. I want to again pray for the various Calvary chapels across the nation of Ukraine. Give people wisdom. And Lord, and of course, churches throughout that land. But we also need to pray. There's so many believers. There's a ton of Calvary Chapel churches in Russia as well. Calvary chapels in Israel. Lord, bless, encourage, strengthen those believers, Lord, in those lands. Speak to us tonight, please. We ask all of it in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, Numbers chapter 4, this chapter is largely about the different responsibilities for the priests in terms of carrying the articles. Notice, actually, skip down Numbers chapter 4, skip down to verse 5 for just a second. It says, when the camp prepares to journey, and this is what they're to do in taking down the covering of the veil, etc., etc. So this is largely related to that. So I'm going to read kind of bigger chunks of it, but you'll get a sense of what they're doing. Because, you know, the Lord would move. There was the pillar of smoke, the cloud of a fire, or vice versa, excuse me. And as he would move, the people would break camp and they would follow the Lord to wherever their next journey would be there, or the next destination in their journey. So this is what the priests needed to do for that. So I'm going to read some bigger chunks of that and just kind of keep this in mind. So chapter 4, book of Numbers, verse 1 says, then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, take a census of the children of Kohath from among the children of Levi, by their families, by their father's house, from 30 years old and above, even to 50 years old, all who enter the service to do the work in the tabernacle of meeting. This is the service of the sons of Kohath in the tabernacle of meeting relating to the most holy thing. So this will be their responsibility for these particular implements. Again, verse 5, when the camp prepares to journey, Aaron and his sons shall come, and they shall take down the covering veil and cover the ark of the testimony with it. And then they shall put on it a covering of badger skins and spread over that a cloth entirely of blue. And they shall insert its poles. Remember, there was the rings on the sides of some of these things. They would put the poles in the side of it so they would carry it. On the table of showbread, they shall spread a blue cloth and put on it the dishes, the pans, the bowls, and the pitchers for pouring, and the showbread shall be on it. They shall spread over them a scarlet cloth and cover the same with the covering of badger skins, and they shall, again, insert its poles. And they shall take a blue cloth and cover the lampstand of the light with its lamps, its wick trimmers, its trays, and all its oil vessels with which they service it. Then, verse 10, they shall put it with all its utensils in a covering of badger skins, and put it on a carrying beam. Over the golden altar they shall spread a blue cloth, and cover it with a covering of badger skins, and they shall insert its poles. Stop at verse 12 here just a moment. I want to just kind of give a quick side note, and give a side note, but not really give you much information about a side note, other than to be careful when you're reading this kind of stuff, and I talk about this often enough, be careful that you don't try to associate some of the practical things here with overly spiritual things. And by that I mean, I find it of interest personally, just in my own reading of this, the various times that you find different colors. So for example, in verse 6, this is a cloth that's entirely of blue. And we saw that the color blue is represented there a handful of times, and the color scarlet. And so the side note is not much of a note in that, be careful that you don't allow numbers and colors and all these different types of things to represent something else. Now, there might very well be some deep spiritual significance to the color blue. It's possible. The color scarlet, I would venture to guess that there's likely more significance to that, in that it's obviously connected to blood, you know, the same color. Isaiah talks about that, though your sins be like scarlet, they shall be made white like wool. So there's these types of things. You find a scarlet thread in the book of Joshua, but just because your mind calls to remembrance another time in the Bible where that color is used, it does not of necessity mean that that color has to represent something else. I'm guessing that it probably does, but just be careful that you're not dogmatic where the scriptures are not. In other words, I don't think in my own reading of this I found anything that says definitively blue represents this as they were packing up and moving the tabernacle of meeting. So just the side note is, be careful with your Bible study. Be okay with it being just intensely practical. And if the Lord had a different representation or spiritual significance in mind, if he reveals that in his word, fantastic. If he doesn't, it's okay to not speculate too much. Anyway, verse 12, then they shall take all the utensils of service with which they minister in the sanctuary, put them in a blue cloth, cover them with a covering of badger skins, and put them on a carrying beam. Also, verse 13, they shall take away the ashes from the altar and spread a purple cloth over it. They shall put on it all its implements with which they minister there, the fire pans, the forks, the shovels, the basins, and all the utensils of the altar, and they shall spread on it a covering of badger skins and insert its poles. And when Aaron and his sons have finished covering the sanctuary and all the furnishings of the sanctuary, when the camp is set to go, then the sons of Kohath shall come to carry them. But they shall not touch any holy thing lest they die. That's why all these things were covered. That's why the poles were in place. These are the things in the tabernacle of meeting which the sons of Kohath are to carry. Verse 16 says, the appointed duty of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, is the oil for the light, the sweet incense, the daily grain offering, the anointing oil, the oversight of all the tabernacle, of all that is in it, with the sanctuary and its furnishings. And then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, verse 17, saying, do not cut off the tribe of the families of the Kohathites from among the Levites, but do this in regard to them, that they may live and not die when they approach most holy things. Aaron and his sons shall go in and appoint each of them to his service and his task. But, verse 20, they shall not go in to watch while the holy things are being covered, lest they die. So perhaps one of the main advantages, I'm laughing at this because what I'm about to say, like, this is the breaking down of the camp. This is the taking apart of the tabernacle, all the pieces, all the parts, all the connecting parts of all of this. I'm laughing because as they would travel to all these different places, they would have to do this. You know, maybe they were there for 2 days and they would break it down and cover it up and then they get moving. And maybe the next place they arrive, maybe they're there for 2 months, that kind of thing. But perhaps one of the main advantages to all of this and this chapter is really simple. And as is often the case, I find in God's economy, I find that so much of this is very often intensely practical. Basically, what you would never hear if they followed their responsibilities to the letter. You would basically never hear this phrase uttered upon arriving at a new location. You know what you would never hear them say? These five words, "I thought you had it." No one was going to say that if they followed the instructions. I mean, it's so detailed. I don't need to describe how detailed it is, but it's intensely detailed. And you would never hear that. Those five little words have brought ruin to many a trip. "I thought you had it." Or equally so, how about this one? I'm sure you said this. I feel like this every time I walk out the door of my house. I look at Christy, I'm like, am I forgetting something? It's this: "I knew I forgot something." You would not hear that from any of these people if they followed the instruction presented there, because God's intensely practical. Even this comes to mind for me. I want to keep moving through our text this evening, but Mark chapter 6 comes to mind for me. At Jesus' miracle of the feeding of the 5,000, you find in Mark chapter 6 in verses 39 and 40, and it's, if you make a note in Numbers chapter 4, you know, 2 years from now, you're going to find it, and you'll be like, why did I reference Mark chapter 6? But in verses 39 and 40 of Mark chapter 6, Jesus told the disciples, the apostles, to have the people sit in the green grass, in ranks, he said, and you might remember what he said, in hundreds and in fifties. Why? Because there would be order to that. For the 5,000 men, plus women, plus children, I mean, this is potentially, you know, 15, 20,000 people, we don't know, but at least 5,000 men, plus women and children. You want to make sure that everybody got something to eat. And oh, you know the story. In fact, I just taught on it a couple weeks ago, but you know that everyone had plenty to eat, and everyone was just absolutely stuffed, and there were leftovers. And why is that possible? Because it wasn't just this mass of people. Jesus wanted to be organized. No, let's make sure this is what it is, in ranks, in hundreds and fifties. In other words, nothing and no one was neglected. I mean, we're talking about the tabernacle. This is the place where God would meet with the people, and the people through the high priest would meet with their God. Nothing was to be neglected. It wasn't like, well, just make sure everybody packs it up. No, there were specifics to all of this. At any rate, I find this fascinating how precise the Lord is with even these things that seem mundane. Verse 21 says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, also take a census of the sons of Gershon by their father's house, by their families. From 30 years old and above, even to 50 years old, you shall number them, all who enter to perform the service to do the work in the tabernacle of meeting. This is the service of the family of the Gershonites in serving and carrying." Again, this is what they're to do. Verse 25, "They shall carry the curtains of the tabernacle and the tabernacle of meeting with its covering, covering of badger skins that's on it, the screen for the door of the tabernacle of meeting, the screen for the door of the gate of the court, the hangings on the court which are around the tabernacle and altar, and their cords, all the furnishings for the service, and all that is made for these things, so shall they serve." Verse 27, "Aaron and his sons shall assign all the service of the sons of the Gershonites, all their tasks and all their service, and you shall appoint to them all their tasks as their duty." Verse 28, "This is the service of the families of the sons of Gershon in the tabernacle of meeting, and their duties shall be under the authority of Ithamar, the son of Aaron, the priest." There, notice some repetition here in verses, verse 23, I suppose, from 30 years old and above. We saw that in verse 3. We'll see this again in verse 30. We'll see it in verse 35. We'll see it in verse 43, as well as verse 47, from 30 years old to 50 years old. That was the serving age for the priests. So that's just the age range in which they would serve. And so this was all the things that this particular group, the sons of the Gershonites, this is what their assignment was. Now, as for the sons of Merari, picking up there in verse 29, this would, of course, would be another family unit, another family group within the tribe of Levi. So verse 29 says, "As for the sons of Merari," or Merari, you shall number them by their families and by their father's house. Again, verse 30, from 30 years old and above, even to 50 years old, you shall number them, everyone who enters the service to do the work of the tabernacle of meeting. And this is what they must carry as all their service for the tabernacle of meeting. The boards of the tabernacle, its bars, its pillars, its sockets, verse 32 says, the pillars around the court with their sockets, pegs and cords, with all their furnishings and all their service, and you shall assign to each man by name the items. I like that, the items he must carry. I like that because, again, it's precise. It's not just, well, would somebody please get that? No, I need you to do this. I need you to do this. I need you, sir, to do this specifically. Verse 33 says, this is the service of the families of the sons of Merari, as all their service for the tabernacle of meeting under the authority of Ithamar, the son of Aaron, the priest. And notice this. This is significant to me. Again, not that it represents some big, deep spiritual thing per se, but as with the other families, there was a priest assigned. Right here in verse 33, it's Ithamar to lead this. There were to be those, again, in verse 32, they were called by name or assigned by name, and Ithamar was this priest that was responsible to maintain the order of this, to make sure that things were processed the way they were to be processed. It's great to have, I'm just going to say this as a pastor, it's great to have people that are called to ministry, 100%, of course, you know, serving with me, serving here at Calvary Chapel, it's just so instrumental. Like, I cannot do this without other people, and that's about the biggest understatement you can imagine. You know, when a church is first getting started, when a church planter goes out, you know, when Pastor Paul Lester moved out here in Northwest Arkansas, and they started in November of 1994, it was largely the Lester family that did so much of the ministry initially, and then as other people who were called to the ministry, and this is what I say concerning this man, Ithamar of the Sons of Merari, not just that people were called to ministry, and not just that people had the ability, and not just the calling and the ability, but the availability to do it. And further, man, it's so wonderful, and all these years into this church being established here in Calvary Chapel, to have responsible people. And this man, Ithamar, was one of those responsible people, even in these super practical areas too. These things are both practical and holy. Holy? Really? Sacred? Yes, this is the tabernacle of meeting. These are holy things. It wasn't just anyone could do it. Not at all. Set apart for the Lord, and these Levites were set apart to his service. And so the practical and the holy all rolled into these responsibilities. And this man, Ithamar, was one of those assigned. You know, I think I said this a couple weeks ago. It's more than just a clipboard. Like, can someone get this, get this, get this? There's a holy duty to all of this. Nothing would be left behind. Again, there would never be those five words, I thought you had it. Which actually reminds me, it's kind of an aside to all of this, and I really do want to cover some ground this evening. We'll see how many chapters we can cover. But it reminds me, it's sort of similar, at least, to Luke chapter 2. And if you're familiar with Luke chapter 2, you know that Mary and Joseph both made the assumption that 12-year-old Jesus was with them on their trip home from Jerusalem. Oh, you know that they had journeyed there. They had journeyed to Jerusalem, Luke tells us, to celebrate the Passover. But on the way home, it's kind of, there's some irony to this, certainly. On the way home, Jesus was nowhere to be found. And this is like the ultimate, I thought you had him kind of moment. Oh, when I was a kid, I don't know, probably in the seventh grade, maybe, my brother was playing in a basketball game, basketball tournament, made my older brother, and it was played at one of the local high schools, and my parents both drove different cars. They were coming from different events or something else to go to the game, and they both, sorry, Mom and Dad, to tell this story, it's probably terrible for you, but they both made the assumption that old Jeremy's with, you know, Mom thought I'm with Dad, Dad thought I was Mom, they drove away, and they got back to the house and go, oh no, Jeremy's just kind of still stuck at this high school, and you know, things are closed down at that point or whatever it was. But what we find in Luke chapter 2 They were already journeying from Jerusalem, heading home. And this is what it says. This is what Luke tells us concerning Mary and Joseph. Supposing him to have been in the company, like maybe one of his aunts or uncles or whoever else, supposing him to be in the company. And then, of course, you know the story. They return to Jerusalem to find him. But simple enough, even in the practical things, and these are holy things, even with the tabernacle of meeting, to just lose sight of the Lord, to lose sight of the sacred in the practical. And I would suggest for us as people of God, for Christians, for followers of Jesus Christ, it's so easy, and it's remarkable how easy this is, even in the practical service of the things that have to be done, to lose sight of Jesus. It's more than just a clipboard. It's more than just people called by name to do these simple and sacred things. The Lord chooses these men by name to do this work. At any rate, let's not lose sight of Jesus even in the sacred. Verse 34. Moses, Aaron, and the leaders of the congregation numbered the sons of the Kohathites by their families and by their father's house from 30 years old and above, even to 50 years old, everyone who entered the service for work in the tabernacle of meeting, and those who were numbered by their families were 2,750. These were the ones who were numbered of the families of the Kohathites, all who might serve in the tabernacle meeting, whom Moses and Aaron numbered according to the commandment of the Lord by the hand of Moses, and those who were numbered by the sons of Gershon, by their family and their father's house, from 30 years old and above, even to 50 years old, everyone who entered the service for the work of the tabernacle meeting, those who were numbered by their families, by their father's house, were 2,630. And then he tells us these are the ones who were numbered of the families of the sons of Gershon, numbered according to the commandment of the Lord. Verse 42, these are the families of the sons of Merari, who were numbered by their families, their father's house, 30 to 50 years old. Same kind of thing. Verse 44, these were numbered by their families, these who were numbered by their families were 3,200. And these are the ones who were numbered of the families of the sons of Merari, whom Moses and Aaron numbered according to the word of the Lord by the hand of Moses. And all who were numbered, verse 46, of the Levites, whom Moses, Aaron, the leaders of Israel, numbered by their families and by their father's houses from 30 to 50, everyone who came to do the work, service, work of bearing burdens in the tabernacle meeting, those who were numbered were 8,580. Verse 49, according to the commandment of the Lord, they were numbered by the hand of Moses, each according to his service and according to his task. Thus they were numbered by him as the Lord commanded Moses. So another probably helpful note there I find is verse 49. We just read it, but it's each according to his service. Notice right in the middle of the verse, each according to his service and according to his task. They were to do what was set before them to do personally. Again, I'm kind of reminded of the New Testament. I'm reminded of the Gospel of John at the very end of the Gospel when Jesus recommissions Peter for ministry. And we're told, as Jesus speaks to Peter about this, that he would stretch out his hands and another would gird him and carry him where he did not wish. And this is John 21, verse 19. Then he, Jesus, spoke, signifying by what death he, Peter, would glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said to him, "Follow me." And then Peter, this is the interesting part. Then Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following. This would be John, who had also leaned on his breast at the supper and said, "Lord, who is the one who betrays you?" And Peter, all this talk about John, verse 21. Peter, seeing John, said to Jesus, "But Lord, what about this man? Like, I know you've asked me to do something, but what about John?" I love Jesus' response. Verse 22, John chapter 21. Jesus said to him, "If I will that he remain until I come, what is that to you, Peter?" Right? "You follow me." Each of us have what we're tasked according to our service and according to our task. We're given certain things to do, and we're responsible for those things. Be faithful to what the Lord has set before you. Please, be faithful to what the Lord has set before you to do. Don't worry about someone else's calling. Don't worry about someone else's task. The Lord has someone in mind to do certain tasks, and he has you in mind to do the tasks that he set before you. Don't, what about this? You follow Jesus. Do what he set before you to do. Chapter 5. Let's jump into chapter 5 here. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the children of Israel that they put out of the camp, notice this, out of the camp, every leper, everyone has a discharge, and everyone who becomes defiled by a corpse. Remember, like if they had touched a dead body. You shall put out both male and female, this both equal. You shall put them outside the camp that they may not defile their camps in the midst of which I dwell. Please notice that. So that they might not defile the camp. This is the camp where the Lord dwells, because he dwells in the midst of his people. And the children of Israel, verse 4 of chapter 5 of the book of Numbers, the children of Israel did so and put them outside the camp as the Lord spoke to Moses. So the children of Israel did. And I came across a really funny article. I don't know, this is 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, something like that. But it was a funny article that basically just highlighted a series of tweets between the Oklahoma Wildlife Department and the general public. And basically this initial tweet that the Oklahoma Wildlife Department tweeted was a picture of like a mountain lion just kind of laying in the snow or playing in the snow or something like it. And the gist of it was the Oklahoma Wildlife Department was encouraging, or rather discouraging, people from bringing cute wild animals into their houses. Like, we're encouraging you to resist the urge to bring wild animals in your house. Like, yes, that is a really cute mountain lion. Do not bring it into your house. And the first tweet, again, had this picture of this mountain lion. And then what the Oklahoma Wildlife Department said is three sentences. You are cold. They have fur. Do not let inside. Like, what does this have to do with? I'll get to what it has to do with Numbers chapter 5. But it was funny because, and if you go, you know, go to Twitter and read this, there was like back and forth tweets on this for days. And the hilarity that ensued was fantastic. But the concept from the Oklahoma Wildlife Department was, sympathy is not a good reason to be unsafe when it comes to mountain lions being let into your, but they're so cute, it's so cold outside, they'll be fine, leave them be. No matter how cute they are, they need to be there, you need to be here, they need to be on this side of the door. On this side, outside. Why? Those things aren't safe. In similar fashion, and this is why I'm thinking of this for Numbers chapter 5, these unhealthy issues had no place in the camp of the children of Israel. And I know I need to not beat a proverbial dead horse here, since we've covered so many of these things, and the Lord gives us so much detail through Leviticus, you know, as well as, and of course, in Exodus, and we'll see some of these things again in Deuteronomy. But these issues had no place in the camp of the children of Israel, so they need to be outside the camp. You need to excuse them from the camp. And these issues remind us, of course, of the consequences of sin. I know we've talked about that. Sin is death here, corpse. That there's the reminder of what sin brings. It brings death. Of course, as with leprosy, sin also just slowly eats away at us. So sin is to be excused as in removed, kicked out of our lives. You're saying, you may be excused now. I would like that to no longer be here in my midst. There's no place for it, for sin, even if it seems harmless. Well, but this guy that has leprosy, he's such a nice guy. And no, he needs to be outside of the camp. We need to make sure that people are kept pure, people are kept safe, free from those things that bring so much damage. Verse 5 says, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel. Verse 6, when a man or woman commits any sin that men commit in unfaithfulness against the Lord, and that person is guilty, then he shall confess the sin which he has committed. He shall make restitution for his trespass in full, plus one-fifth of it, and give it to the one he has wronged. But if the man has no relative to whom restitution may be made for the wrong, the restitution for the wrong must go to the Lord for the priest, in addition to the ram of the atonement with which atonement is being made. Just real quick here, what's happening. This is no doubt pointing us back to Leviticus chapters 5 and 6, about making restitution for things that were stolen, if you remember that whole conversation. So the concept here is you need to bring this back to them, make sure you make this restitution, plus the one-fifth, plus that 20%. But notice verse 8 again, if the man has no relative to whom restitution may be made for the wrong, the restitution for the wrong must go to the Lord. It'll go to the Lord by way of the priest. So like, even if someone has passed away, even if someone's died, the restitution needed to be made. So verse 9, every offering of all the holy things of the children of Israel, which they bring to the priest, shall be his, and every man's holy things, things that are set apart, sanctified, consecrated, shall be his. Whatever any man gives the priest shall be his. So restitution needs to be made. And then we get to a fairly odd section. And I'm just going to read the whole of it, and I'm going to make a few comments about it. And really, it's the entirety or the remaining portion of chapter 5. So it's a fairly odd section. Odd maybe at first glance, but as we kind of look at it from afar a little bit, it might make a little bit more sense. But it's definitely difficult to read. Verse 11, and the Lord spoke to Moses, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, if any man's wife goes astray and behaves unfaithfully toward him, and a man lies with her carnally and is hidden from the eyes of her husband, so she cheats on her husband, this is adultery here, and it's concealed that she's defiled herself, her husband has no idea, there was no witness against her, nor was she caught. Verse 14, if the spirit of jealousy comes upon him, and he becomes jealous of his wife who has defiled herself, or if the spirit of jealousy comes upon him, and he becomes jealous of his wife, although she has not defiled herself, it's possible he's just being jealous. Then, verse 15, then the man shall bring his wife to the priest. He shall bring the offering required for her, one-tenth of an ephah of barley meal. He shall pour no oil on it and put no frankincense on it. This is not to be like a sweet aroma kind of thing, because it's a grain offering of jealousy, an offering for remembering, for bringing iniquity to remembrance. And verse 16, the priest shall bring her near and set her before the Lord. Verse 17, the priest shall take holy water in an earthen vessel, and take some of the dust that is on the floor of the tabernacle and put it, that dust from the floor of the tabernacle where they meet with the Lord, put it in the water. Then verse 18, notice this, the priest shall stand the woman before the Lord, uncover the woman's head, like let her hair down basically, and put the offering for remembrance in her hands, which is the grain offering of jealousy, and the priest shall have in his hand the bitter water that brings a curse. And the priest, verse 19, shall put her under oath and say to the woman, if no man has lain with you, and if you have not gone astray to uncleanness while under your husband's authority, be free from this bitter water that brings a curse. But if you have gone astray while under your husband's authority, and if you have defiled yourself and some man other than your husband has lain with you, then, verse 21, the priest shall put the woman under the oath of the curse, and he shall say to the woman, the Lord make you a curse, and an oath among the people when the Lord makes your thigh rot and your belly swell. And it's possible that this is talking about possibly that she'll not be able to have children. It's probably another study, a whole other conversation. You can dig into that if you'd like. But verse 22, and may this water that causes the curse go into your stomach and make your belly swell and your thigh rot. Then the woman shall say, amen. So be it. Like, okay, I agree with these terms. Amen. I agree. Then verse 23, the priest shall write these curses in a book. This is where it gets interesting. As if it's not already. He shall write these curses in a book, and he shall scrape them off into the bitter water. He shall make the woman drink the bitter water that brings a curse, and the water that brings the curse shall enter her to become bitter. Then, verse 25, the priest shall take the grain offering of jealousy from the woman's hand, shall wave the offering before the Lord, and bring it to the altar, and the priest shall take a handful of the offering as its memorial portion, burn it on the altar, and afterward make the woman drink the water. When he has made her drink the water, then it shall be, if she has defiled herself and behaved unfaithfully toward her husband, that the water that brings a curse will enter her and become bitter, and her belly will swell, her thigh will rot, and the woman will become a curse among her people. Interesting, there's nothing intrinsically like poisonous in scraped dried ink off of a book and dust that's in the tabernacle and the barley, for example. None of those things would be inherently sickening to someone. So she says amen to this, she's agreed to this, and so this is what happens. But verse 28, if the woman has not defiled herself and is clean, then she shall be free and may conceive children. So she'll be able to have kids. Verse 29, this is the law of jealousy when a wife, while under her husband's authority, goes astray and defiles herself, or when the spirit of jealousy comes upon a man and he becomes jealous of his wife, then he shall stand the woman before the Lord, and the priest shall execute all this law upon her, and then the man shall be free from iniquity, but that woman shall bear her guilt. They're like, okay. Okay, I'm sure in one of my Bibles, just in my own personal Bible reading, I think I've got some kind of note that says, I do not understand this. Well, let me just make a handful of comments, and hopefully we'll at least be able to make some sense of this. This seems to allow for some kind of legal precedent among the Israelites, and for them specifically, of course. Likely, based on this law, the same curse part of it would apply the other way too. So in other words, here's the specifics of it. It's not going to give a case study for every single possible scenario within the nation. So it's entirely possible that this would be the case for a man if he's also potentially behaved in an adulterous manner and his wife has the sense, I think that maybe he's been cheating on me, this kind of thing. It would also set the precedent, of course, just generally speaking, that adultery was sinful, of course, and people knew this, and that jealous husbands, who were jealous no matter what, could be confronted with the truth. So rather than this lingering kind of question mark over the scenario potentially for their whole lives, there would be an answer. The Lord would intervene in this supernaturally. Somehow he would intervene in this and show people what was so. If the wife was faithful, there was this mechanism in place to justify the wife. Well, I think she cheated on me. I'm jealous. I think this is... If that's not the case, then she would be justified. Then the priest would be able to say, the Lord has spoken. You are wrong, sir. And of course, this would be an open rebuke to that husband who's made such an accusation. Like, this isn't just like, hey, let's go visit the priest. This is a serious endeavor. This is a serious thing here. When I read this and I read some of these types of passages, what comes to mind for me is like, man, I wonder how often this happened in the history of the children of Israel. I'm guessing probably not all that often because it was such a serious thing. Like, if I'm saying this and I'm wrong, of course it's going to make me look really bad. If I'm right, it's going to make her look really, and am I wrong? And it's a big deal. There would be rebuke openly either way. And so whichever party was in the wrong, once the truth, and again, this was all clearly established through some supernatural means, once the truth was presented, that wrongful party would look really bad. By the way, notice just by observation, what was the thing or the things that made the bitter water bitter? Notice there, the first thing is in verse 17. Did you catch that? I think I highlighted it. Dust from the floor of the tabernacle. Again, the tabernacle, the dwelling place of God. The holy place, this place set apart where they would meet with the Lord, the dust there of that place. And then secondly, the ink of the curse. I like what David Guzik said. You guys notice I quote David Guzik often enough. I'll tell you, if you really want to dig into some great Bible studies, spend time listening to Pastor David Guzik as well as reading his commentaries. Just fantastic. So for you students of the Bible, David Guzik's fantastic. This is what he says on this. The combination of seeing the holiness of God and the penalty to sinners truly is bitter. It's amazing because those are the two elements really of what's required for salvation. really? If those are the two things required of salvation, the recognition of these two things, the penalty for me as a sinner, I deserve death. I deserve damnation because of my sin, because of my sins, because of my sinfulness. And the holiness of God, there's no way he should receive such a one as I, because he's so infinitely holy, so far removed from me. Surely, if I as a sinner could get to God, there has to be some kind of means. And there is, and that's the cross of Jesus Christ that allows the holy God and sinful man to be connected. And so it's the recognition of both of these things that allows this. And again, I love this from Guzik. The combination of seeing the holiness of God and the penalty to sinners truly is bitter. And you have to get to that place of knowing you need salvation in order to receive it. So this whole, again, kind of odd chapter, but as you dig into it and ask a few more questions, it seems to help. There seems to be some sort of, in general, not just for the people of Israel, but in married couples, there seems to be some sort of spousal intuition built into marriages. But there's also some people that are also just more prone to jealousy. They're maybe even naturally, or maybe they have reason to be, but they're just more on the jealous side for one reason or another. And so this would provide a means and a mechanism to establish what was really the case. You know, some people are just jealous, but they're not correct in their thoughts. They're not correct in their assessment. So this would allow some clarity for this. I think we can do this. I can do this, and you guys can. You can turn it off if you're good at this point. I'm just going to quickly read through chapter 6. This is the law for the Nazarite vow, and perhaps the most famous Nazarite of all, Samson from the book of Judges. He honestly should have spent more time here in Numbers, chapter 6. In fact, you Bible students, again, for you guys that are, you know, Wednesday night kind of people, you might turn to the book of Judges. You might do that right now, but you might turn to the book of Judges, and you might make a note there in the book of Judges, starting in chapter 13, but really chapters 13, 14, 15, and 16, those four chapters dealing with Samson, and just put Numbers chapter 6. Like, there's certain things in his life where he, as a Nazarite, basically rejected this vow. Well, then the Lord spoke to Moses, chapter 6, verse 1, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when either a man or woman consecrates an offering to take the vow of a Nazarite, to separate himself to the Lord, he shall separate himself from wine and similar drink. He shall drink neither vinegar made from wine nor vinegar made from similar drink. Neither shall he drink any grape juice nor eat fresh grapes or raisins. All the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine from seed to skin." So totally removed from that. Pardon me. So this vow was a very personal one. Someone dedicated to the Lord, wanted to be further dedicated to the Lord, wanted to be closer to the Lord. As such, they would willingly separate themselves from some basic comforts or basic freedoms of life. They were welcome to drink wine, of course, just as long as they weren't drunk. But for this, they were not even so much a hint of it, not even a grape. That was a specific calling or a specific choice to take on this calling for a certain amount of time. Paul the Apostle, you can read about this in Acts chapter 18. He seemed to take this Nazarite vow for a season. John the Baptist sure seemed to have this upon his life. You can look at this in Luke chapter 1 and verse 15, Luke 1:15 for John the Baptist. And then over in the book of Judges, again, this is Judges chapter 13 and verse 4. Manoah's wife seemed to have taken this vow personally as well. So this time of personal dedication, further sanctification, and not so dissimilar to fasting, but this was more all-encompassing. It was more, let me even say it this way, it was almost more formal, more public. Verse 5, "All the days of the vow of his separation, no razor shall come upon his head," don't laugh at me, until the days "are fulfilled for which he separated himself to the Lord, he shall be holy. Then he shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow." Verse 6, all the days that he separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body. And you're, again, think about Samson here. He shall not make himself unclean even for his father or his mother, for his brother or sister, when they die, because his separation to God is on his head. All the days of his separation shall be holy to the Lord. You might remember when we were studying Leviticus chapter 1, the priests could only touch the dead bodies of their immediate family members for their burial, but they weren't to touch other dead bodies. The high priest, all the different details, you can go back to Leviticus 21, look into that, but the high priest, they wouldn't do that at all. So the Nazarites, in like manner, totally steered clear, or they were to steer clear of this. And if anyone dies very suddenly beside him, just kind of drops dead, verse 9, and he defiles his consecrated head, then he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day he shall shave it. And so the practice of this shaving of the heads in here, and again, Acts chapter 18, I think I said, and then the growing of their locks was part of the public process of it. You could see who were those who were taking part in this vow. So if he or she came into contact with a dead body, they would kind of start the process all over, and this would be the process. Again, let me read verse 9. If anyone dies very suddenly, he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day he shall shave it. Verse 10. Then the eighth day he shall bring two turtle doves or two young pigeons to the priest, to the door of the tabernacle meeting. And verse 11. The priest shall offer one as a sin offering and the other as a burnt offering, and make atonement for him because he sinned in regard to the corpse. He shall sanctify his head that same day, verse 12, he shall consecrate to the Lord the days of his separation and bring a male lamb in its first year as a trespass offering, but the former days shall be lost because his separation was defiled. So they would just start afresh from then. And then the process further, verse 13, all the way to verse 21. Now this is the law of the Nazarite. When his days of his separation are fulfilled, he shall be brought to the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Again, public. He shall present his offering to the Lord, one male lamb in its first year without blemish as a burnt offering, one ewe lamb in its first year without blemish as a sin offering, one ram without blemish as a peace offering, so different offerings for these different things, a basket of unleavened bread, cakes of fine flour mixed with oil, unleavened wafers anointed with oil, and their grain offering with their drink offerings. And then the priest shall bring them before the Lord and offer his sin offering and his burnt offering, and he shall offer the ram as a sacrifice of a peace offering to the Lord with the basket of unleavened bread. The priest shall also offer its grain offering and its drink offering. And then the Nazarite shall shave his consecrated head at the door of the tabernacle meeting, and shall take the hair from his consecrated head and put it on the fire which is under the sacrifice of the peace offering. And people would have smelled that. It would have stunk, but there would have been this recognition of what's happening. Verse 19, the priest shall take the boiled shoulder of the ram, one unleavened cake from the basket and one unleavened wafer, and put them upon the hands of the Nazarites after he has shaved his consecrated head, and the priest shall wave them as a wave offering before the Lord. They are holy for the priest, together with the breast of the wave offering and the thigh of the heave offering. After that, the Nazarite may drink wine. And this is the law of the Nazarite, who vows to the Lord the offering for his separation, and besides that, whatever else his hand is able to provide, according to the vow which he takes, so he must do according to the law of his separation. So kind of a beautiful thing that people would choose to do, males or females would choose to do, that I just want to be further sanctified, further separated unto the Lord for his work, for his business, for a season. What a wonderful concept. For a season, just I want to set myself apart to do something for the Lord. Probably some application in that. Finally, close the chapter, verse 22. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, verse 23, speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, like, here's what you're going to say. This is like a written prayer, essentially, in the Bible. Verse 24, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Like his countenance, his face, may his face be upon you and give you peace. So, verse 27, they shall put my name, don't miss that, my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them. The name of the Lord on them, this is him being identified to them and them to him. Notice here in verses 24, 25, and 26, it's the Lord three times. The Lord bless you. The Lord make his face shine upon you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you. So this is not, this is just a quick side note here as we bring this to a close. It's not an argument for the Trinity, but with the Trinity as an established, understood biblical doctrine, this is all the more clear. This is the threefold blessing from the threefold, the triune God. Notice what happens here. The Lord bless you. God's desire for you is blessing. I don't know if you know that, but God's desire for you is blessing. Notice there's peace in our direction and his graciousness towards us. I love that. You'll also notice here in verses 24, 25, and 26, the word you six times. Look at it again, verse 24. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. I love that because the Lord is aware of us. He loves us. He wants to establish his peace, his grace upon our lives, his blessing upon our lives. This is Old Testament stuff, and yet just the richness, the vastness of his grace on this side of the cross, how much, I'm not sure if I can say this, and I'm not sure I'm right, but I'm going to say it. How much more does he want to bless us now that we're born again, saved? Oh, it's probably an equal measure that he would bless the people of Israel, but that he would want to bless us as followers of Jesus Christ now that we are part of his family. Oh, there's some application in this too. And so may the Lord bless you. Lord, just shine his face upon you. May he be gracious unto you. May he give you peace. May you decide, even as these Nazarites would decide, I want to walk with the Lord. I want to walk more closely with the Lord. If there's things in my life that I know I need to either completely separate from my life and just be rid of them, good riddance, get that out of here. Let's do that. There's other things that you say, you know, there's a season in my life right now. I think I just need to seek the Lord a little bit more diligently. And so there's certain things, they're not inherently bad, sinful, wicked, whatever. It's just they're nothing in particular. And maybe I just need to take a time again, like fasting, and just separate those things from my life for the time being. And may you, oh, as you walk closely with the Lord Jesus, you will find how much more blessed, even in difficulties and trials, your life might be. God bless you guys. Thanks for watching. Wish we could be together. Love you. Miss you. Look forward to being together, Lord willing, on Sunday morning. Talk to you guys soon. Thanks again. We'll see you later.